Tonight on The Book Show, we're on the move, reading the world around us as we go.
The icons that we use today are mostly based on a group that were developed in the 1970s.
We meet taxi drivers and bicycle couriers.
As a courier, you learn to inhabit the places in between the pickups and the drops. You learn the secret smells of the city, the earthy comfort of freshly laid tarmac.
And our final destination this evening is Bill Bryson, who knows all about life on the road.
But what I was always looking for, I really was genuinely is looking for the kind of quintessential perfect small town that I always saw in Hollywood movies.
Our journey begins in the airport.
Hi, good. Here's my boarding pass.
We've all experienced a mad dash through departures, security, maybe even duty-free to catch a flight. There's no time for reading as we run around a busy airport, but actually, reading is something we never stop doing. Through wayfinding.
Okay, gates 401 to 426. 409, this way, okay.
Wayfinding is a way of orientating yourself in a environment in order to get from one place to another.
That's graphic designer Paul McBride. Graphic design plays its part in taking us from A to B.
Orientating yourself in an environment, deciding where you want to go, and then when you're travelling, ensuring that you're going in the right direction, and then finally getting to the destination and knowing you've arrived.
Design history lecturer Mary Ann Bulger decodes the signs.
We read signs, and we read them like we read any other text, but what we sometimes forget about reading all texts is the way in which we read what the words look like. So we're reading information well beyond what the simple sign tells us we're going to Dunleary or to Tramore. We're reading the character of the letters as well as what they actually say.
Plain, bright backgrounds or dark backgrounds with bright typefaces with clear definition. That's to help legibility. They're usually supported with icons. These are universal. For example, if you're in an airport, there is icons that are for taking off, for arrivals, for departures, for parking, for transport. They support the text that's beside that. So if you don't understand English, for example, or if you're just very quickly looking at the sign, that communicates very clearly whether you're taking off, whether you're landing, or whether you're going to the car park.
When we think about signage, we tend to think that it's about legibility and information and pure functionality, but actually it's about rhetoric. We read the form of the words just as much as we read their content, perhaps even more. If you look at the international symbol for the bar, it's a martini glass with an olive. It's not a pint. It's a knife and fork and not a pair of chopsticks. And part of that is because they work better as icons.
Final word in call, Ryanair, final call.
The shapes are more instantly recognisable when they're simplified. The icons that we use today are mostly based on a group that were developed in the US in the 1970s. They're culturally specific.
Another couple of minutes, we'll be ready. Once we've confirmed we have everybody on board, we'll close up the door and start the journey.
Wayfinding can be subtle and embedded into the building, where the shape of the tiles can be angled in such a way that they become arrows and lead you in a direction very subtly. It's been considered from the start. Most people aren't aware that these signs are designed and it's so well considered. When wayfinding works at its best, you don't notice it at all. You're being guided to wherever you need to go. It's almost invisible.
And thanks to Paul McBride and Mary Ann Bulger for their navigation skills. Writer John Day is also familiar with navigating chaos. He spent years working as a bicycle courier in London.
Leighton, Leabridge Road, Hackney, Essex Road, Bloomsbury, Kingsway. As a courier, you learn to inhabit the places in between the pickups and the drops. You learn the secret smells of the city, summer's burnt metallic tang, the sweetness of petrol, the earthy comfort of freshly laid tarmac. Some parts of London have their own smells, like olfactory postcodes. The shisha bars on Edgware Road haze the area with sweet smoke. The mineral tang of Billingsgate Fish Market wafts over the Isle of Dogs. Riding a bike for a living means you learn to read the road too, calculating routes, anticipating snarl-ups, dancing round potholes almost unconsciously. It's an activity that forces you to think of the city in literary terms. With its signs and painted hieroglyphics, the road is an encyclopedia of movement. Drive here, walk here, park here, no stopping here. Look down and the tarmac tells you what to do. Traffic lights regulate the entire mechanism like enormous clocks, telling you when to move and when to stop.
I'm with John Day, who's a lecturer at King's College London and a former bicycle courier. And his current book is a long essay, Cycle Geography, Journeys of a London Bicycle Courier. And over the course of seven chapters, John, which is a blend of memoir and history and literature, is a very compelling account of life as a bike courier. But it also sort of presents itself as a bit of a subculture exploration. What kind of people did you meet who had become couriers?
There's a huge range of people I encountered do the job. It is quite a flexible job. As a cycle courier, you're employed as a self-employed subcontractor, so you only get paid for the work that you do, which is bad in some respects, but it does afford this kind of freedom and flexibility, which attracts people who are doing other things often. There are lots of writers and photographers and actors who kind of use it as a day job to subsidize their other creative pursuits. And then there are those who do the job really because they can't do anything else. They're either so antagonistic towards a 9-to-5 existence that they can't fit in an office. Or, you know, there's lots of kind of dubiously employed economic migrants, people who can't be officially employed. There's a kind of grey economy to it too. But it does kind of foster this incredibly strong sense of community that I really found exciting and inspiring in many ways.
In a city like London, you have the knowledge, which is the underground aspect of it, but the geographical map, if you like, that everyone knows of is the A to Z. It's a classic. What do you mean when you talk about the tyranny of maps?
Maps have a tendency, I think, to constrain the possibilities of travel. They tell you where it's possible to go. And that's obviously a very useful thing in some respects, certainly to a bicycle courier. It's necessary knowledge, it's necessary constraint. But I did get the feeling after 3 or 4 years on the road that I knew the map and nothing more. And I had this kind of urgent feeling that I should get off the map, that I should explore territory that was unmapped. And I think the tradition that I found kind of, again, very compelling when I was thinking about these things is that of psychogeography. And the psychogeographers were this group of avant-garde sociologists in late 50s, early 60s Paris, who decided that, you know, we were all constrained in various ways. And one way to combat that was to go on derives or drifts through urban space and inculcate strategies that would allow us to, you know, get off the map. They did things like try to navigate Paris using a map of Berlin and played these kind of psychogeographic games where they drew words or phrases or symbols onto urban maps and walked the lines of those symbols and then document what they encountered along the way. Many people, even lifelong Londoners, don't really know the city they live in. They have vague notions of east and west, of north and south. They associate certain areas with certain activities, work and leisure, home and away. But they're isolated from the whole by London's scale and by those mediating technologies through which they generally encounter it. Screens and maps and the public transport networks which conspire to divorce people from places. Conditioned by these ways of encountering the city, before I became a courier, I had only vague notions of its topography. London had been for me an archipelago of concrete islands, but couriering drained the ocean between them, drawing the map together in my mind.
The book refers to many literary figures from Coleridge to Ian Sinclair to Edward Thomas to Roland Barthes. And you also talk quite a bit about Samuel Beckett and Flann O'Brien. So what are the links between those writers and bicycles?
Well, I think in the case of Flann O'Brien, I mean, Flann O'Brien is the sort of patron saint of literary cyclists in many ways. I mean, in The Third Policeman, he describes this kind of sinister relationship that's developed between bicycles and people in the parish, this kind of circular hell of purgatory that he describes in that novel, where people who ride their bikes too long begin to become entwined with their bikes, the atoms of each interchange, and bicycles start behaving like people stealing from pantries, and people start behaving like bicycles sleeping in hallways with one arm propped against the wall and so on. And there are these kind of sinister undercurrents. And I think I was kind of interested to discover in my reading, and Beckett too, of course, in Malloy, and for Beckett the bicycle is this kind of prosthesis, this crutch that keeps the frail human body together. Hugh Kenner calls it the Cartesian centaur, this idea of the image of bicycle and rider is something akin to that of the horse and rider that was kind of such a conceit in earlier times. And I think it's striking that it's a kind of Irish literary tradition and a French one in which these ideas are most strongly manifested. The biker seems to be more firmly embedded in the literary and cultural imaginations of those countries, and indeed of much of continental Europe, than it is in the English literary imagination.
It took us quite a long time to get here today, but we didn't come by bike. We took planes, we took trains and taxis, and along the way we were sort of reading signs and figuring out our way using maps. How does a cycle courier differ in terms of, say, from a walker or a passenger in terms of how they experience a city?
I think sort of in a variety of ways. I mean, one obviously, to make any money as a courier, you need to know where you are and where you're going. You need to have quite a good geographic knowledge of London. Not quite to the same extent, I suppose, as a London cabbie does. But there is definitely a similar sense of kind of ownership of the map, that you know it in a way that other users of the city, other kind of travellers, don't.
One way you wouldn't get lost in London is if you had what is known as the knowledge. What is the knowledge?
The official knowledge, capitalised knowledge, is the sort of drawn out and medieval training scheme that London taxi drivers have to go through before they're awarded their green badge, which is their kind of accreditation that they are licensed to be taxi drivers. Over the course of, I think, you know, 2 to 5 years, you have a series of appearances with a kind of group of old cabbies, I guess, who give you a starting point and an end point, and you're asked to intone a litany of the points of interest and streets that you'll pass on your journey between those two locations. So it's this kind of very potent, disembodied and performance, really. It's kind of a Beckettian play or something.
I'm going to have to do a bit of it. I can't do it right here. Is that okay?
Yeah.
My name is Samantha Dillon and I'm a London black cab driver and I have the knowledge. But when I said to my kids I'm doing the knowledge, they said, but Mum, we really love you. You're dyslexic, you've got no sense of direction and you can't read a map. And I was like, yeah, I could feel Annika's challenge coming on. A bit like the kids learning the times tables, repetitiveness.
And I guess you never forget it once you learn it, do you?
No, it's interesting because they've done a test on some cab drivers and they got them to not use any knowledge. I think it's about 3 or 4 weeks. And they could only follow a sat-nav, so not to look at the A to Z or anything. And then they tested them and their hippocampus was starting to get smaller.
Goodness. Is there anything else you can only use the knowledge for the London streets, or is there any other benefit to learning the knowledge?
Yeah, it helped me with my spelling after.
Do it.
And also my memory. Wow. It's got so much better. So I can picture, if I lose my keys, I can almost go back into a sequence of stuff. And find where the keys are, like little boxes. If I wrote something down 3 times, Dartmouth Park Avenue, it's that eye to contact with the hand. So I had to do that to remember. So inevitably it helped with my spelling. It helped with the formation of letters, the sounding. So my spelling became much better. I think that's why. I don't know. I presume that's why.
Now I want to learn it. I think
there must be something in it to keeping the brain alert and you know, keeps the rest of you sort of in good health.
It sounds like it.
So maybe I could branch off and start up a therapy thing, couldn't I? How to keep young. I'll teach you the knowledge.
London cab driver Samantha Dillon there with the knowledge. And before that, you heard John Day. His book, Cyclogeography, is published by Notting Hill Editions. Next, for travel writer Bill Bryson, exploring the world often brings him closer to home.
But what I was always looking for, I really was genuinely, is looking for the kind of quintessential perfect small town that I always saw in Hollywood movies. It's a Wonderful Life type towns. And we never quite found them. I mean, we see sometimes little bits of towns that look pretty attractive, but there was never the perfect town. And I think, in a strange way, I've been looking for that my whole life. Just the place that would be the ideal place to live. And that's where I'm always happiest, when I'm in a community, whatever size it is, whether it's a village or a big city, that has that feeling of livability about it, that is attractive, but not just architecturally attractive, but has some kind of magic to it and some kind of magnetism. That's what I'm always looking for, and that's where I am happiest as a traveller.
Bill Bryson emerged 20 years ago as a travel writer with his book Notes from a Small Island. It's a memoir of his journey through the UK. And his latest book, The Road to Little Dribbling, revisits Great Britain with characteristic humour and witty observations. His travels have taken him from Australia to his own kitchen cupboard, but when I met him, we chatted about Walk in the Woods, when he trekked the Appalachian Trail with his friend Katz.
It was really tough. It was the hardest thing I've ever done in my whole life. And you cannot imagine it. The distance in miles, which is what I still use, is 2,200 miles. It's the longest long-distance footpath in the world, and every bit of it is in a wilderness area, although it does occasionally drop down and get near towns and go up a couple of high streets, but mostly it's entirely wilderness. You're away. You have to carry all your own food. You have to carry tents and sleeping bags and all of that. And you can't prepare yourself mentally for it, because you just, if I asked you to imagine 2,200 miles or 3,500 kilometers or whatever it is, all you can imagine is airplane miles or car miles or, you know, some kind of public transportation miles. This is foot miles, and you just, you know, there's nothing in your life. It's a little bit like saying, you know, imagine swimming the Atlantic Ocean. It's just, it's beyond what you can conceive. But what particularly troubled me as I was doing it was this feeling that nothing is happening. I mean, walking is an incredibly repetitious activity. It is really just day after day putting one foot in front of another. And I felt lots of times that we weren't really having interesting encounters, or that wasn't much going on. It was just me and my friend Katz, day after day alone, kind of in the woods. And he was in a gloomy place at the time. He went with me on this hike because he was trying to get his life together, but he wasn't very, very loquacious. So I was just thinking the whole time we're doing this, I'm never going to get a book out of this. I might as well quit now. And I'm very pleased that, you know, we did both persevere, and although we didn't succeed in walking the whole trail, we did persevere.
There was also a film made of the book not that long ago with Robert Redford. Did you feel that he captured you well, and did you get to meet him?
I did get to meet him. They invited us out, me and my wife, to the Sundance Film Festival last February. And that was the first time I saw the movie. But we're sitting in a darkened auditorium, and there's Robert Redford on my right and my wife on my left. And this, you know, the movie starts, and there's Robert Redford on a big screen answering to my name. And I really, really felt like nudging him and saying, that's my name. You know, as if he would be a surprise to him. Like, it was a great coincidence. And then, of course, I realized that, well, of course it's my name, because this is, you know, it's based on my book. And then very quickly, it stopped being about me in any meaningful way. Partly because, you know, they're imagining everything. They're imagining what kind of car I owned. They're imagining what kind of house I lived in. They're taking lots and lots of inevitable liberties with compressing events, or had to change the age of the two hikers by 30 years because Robert Redford and Nick Nolte are so much older than Katz and I were. But I still loved it. I was charmed by it. And I thought they did a wonderful job of capturing the chemistry of the friendship, this dawning friendship between the two hikers.
Some people might not know that you're actually a UK citizen as well as a US citizen. And is there any sense that sort of insider-outsider experience has had an impact on you as a writer?
Yeah, I should think so. I mean, I think there's real value in always having a little distance from the topics that you're writing about. And one of the advantages I have in writing about Britain is, and indeed living in Britain, is that although I understand the country pretty intimately, I've been connected with it very closely for 40 years now. At the same time, I'm still an outsider, and it gives you this privileged position that I can kind of join the party when things are going great, but when, you know, if they get knocked out of the Rugby World Cup in the first round, I can stand back and say, these poor people, they can't play rugby for toffee.
You took the UK citizenship test. How did that go?
Well, luckily it went okay. It's not all that hard in practice, but it is hard in theory, because they ask you a lot of, you have to know an awful lot of detailed questions, things that nobody knows. I mean, not even the best educated Briton. The one I remember particularly was that you have to know who a 19th century character named Sake Din Mohammed was, and the answer is that he is the person who introduced shampoo to Britain. So it's a lot of it is slightly, it's kind of charming in that eccentric British way, but a lot of it is, it seems a little ridiculous. But what happens is you just study the guidebook very carefully, in much the same way you would if you were taking a driving test, and then you take the test and pass the test, and then you forget everything that you ever learned in the guidebook. And so the test began. The first question was, you've seen Eastleigh, are you sure you want to stay in Britain? Actually, I don't recall what the first question was or any of those that followed. We weren't allowed to bring anything to the desk, so I couldn't take notes or tap my teeth thoughtfully with a pencil. The test consisted of 24 multiple choice questions and took only about 3 minutes. You either know the answers or you don't. I presented myself at the supervisor's desk upon completion, and we waited together while the computer checked my answers, a process that took about as long as the test itself. And at last he told me with a smile that I had passed. But he couldn't tell me exactly how I did. The computer only indicated pass or fail.
Can we talk a bit about the road to Little Dribbling? It is an imaginary place, right?
Yes, it is an imaginary place.
But you do talk as well about the idea of the Bryson line. And I'm wondering, why didn't you kind of own that and call it the Bryson line and just put yourself out there as on the cover as the title?
Oh, well, I came up with this concept of the Bryson line, and then it seemed an awfully vain thing to do. I mean, so I've just made a little joke of it in the book, and I decided not to dwell on it in the book. But the explanation to that is that one of the things the guidebook for the citizenship tells you is that the longest distance in the mainland, across the mainland of Britain, is from Land's End to John O'Groats in the north of Scotland, which it patently is not, because you can only make that a straight line if you cross the sea on three or four different places. And I thought, well, what is actually the longest straight line you can do without going across salt water? And it turns out that it's from about Bognor Regis to Cape Wrath in the northwest of Scotland. So I thought that would be kind of my task, to get from Bognor Regis to Cape Wrath. I was so pleased to have discovered this. I couldn't find any reference to the longest straight line on the British mainland anywhere else. So I thought, this is my discovery. I think we should call it the Bryson Line. I'm still waiting for the world to pick it up. But I decided not to dwell on it. So what I do in the book is I begin at Bognor Regis and I finish at Cape Wrath, but then I go all over the place.
I've flown from Dublin to London to see you. Dublin's not that far away, 50-minute flight. And I'm wondering, how much time have you spent in Dublin or Ireland? And it's one of those places that you haven't really written about.
No, I haven't, and to my great shame. And it's not because I'm not drawn to it, I can promise you. Almost all my forebears came from Ireland during the time of the potato famine. My father's side, they were all Ulster Protestants, and on my mother's side, they were all Irish Catholics. And so I've always kept Ireland as this thing that I'm going to do one day. As part of me, I think, is probably a little bit afraid of the commitment I'd have to make in order to try and understand it. Because of the kind of travel books I write, I have to feel comfortable and confident that I can go in and do quite a lot of mickey-taking. And although I've been to Ireland on a number of occasions, I've really seen very, very little that I would want to tease about or make fun of. I genuinely think it's an absolutely, you know, tickety-boo society. It's friendly, they love a drink, you know, everything is great. They're much more on top of an awful lot of social issues than Britain. It's a lot cleaner in terms of litter. I need it to be more squalid or more, you know, I just need to, I'm not quite sure what I would get my hooks into there. And that's always worried me.
That's a very good excuse. I'm wondering, whenever I think about travel writers, any travel writers, the process for them, do they write in the place while they're there, or do they, you know, map and photograph and take notes and then come back, digest the experience and then write it down? How do you do it?
I do take notes, but not copious notes. I do try to leave it to my memory. I have this belief that, you know what it's like when you come back just from a holiday, you're sort of immediately, you're flooded with recollections, and there's so many that you can hardly, you know, you hardly know what to tell your friends about what the holiday you've just had. But if you wait a month or 6 weeks, then a lot of the extraneous stuff kind of drops away, and what you're left with is, I believe, is the stuff worth writing about. So I sort of leave that as a natural process to happen. I do take a lot of photographs just as aid memoirs, you know, just to help me remember what a particular thing looked like. And I will jot down anything that I think I might want to reproduce verbatim, like an inscription on a gravestone or, you know, something that was on a hoarding or something like that. But otherwise, I leave it largely to memory. And I know from experience, you know, from as fact, that I often get things wrong. I even had that with the road to Little Dribbling. I went back to Durham after I'd been there and written about it in good faith, and something was completely different from the way I remembered it. So that's a risk you have. But, you know, I'm not writing encyclopedias. I'm writing impressionistic books about experiences I had. So I'm not too troubled if it's not 100% accurate in terms of my descriptions of plays.
Well, we've come to the end of our time here with you, Bill. End of the Bryson line. It's time for me to go back to Dublin. So thanks for talking to us. Thank you to our producer, Regan Hutchins, to series producer, Zoe Cummins. We'll talk to you next week.